Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll deal with a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and speak about events unfolding in Lebanon following the assassination of the former Prime Minister. We'll try and find out who was behind the assassination and how the chips may fall in a broader Middle East scenario, which we'll explore with Dr. George Irani, who is a professor at the Royal Roads University in British Columbia. He was previously the Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace, and he taught at the American University in Beirut. And we'll also talk about North Korea and try and understand why the North Korean dictator, Kim Jong-il, needs a nuclear weapon, perhaps for his own survival. We'll be talking with veteran foreign correspondent and professor of journalism, Bradley Martin, who teaches journalism at the LSU. He's formerly was the Asia Bureau Chief of Newsweek, the Asia Wall Street Journal, and Asia Times and the Asian Financial Intelligence. So we'll be talking to him about Kim Jong-il and some slightly different take in terms of some new information coming out of North Korea, that the grip of the last Stalinist dictator, maybe, or not, I guess Castro's in that club too, may be coming apart. And we'll also talk about the corporate corruption of higher education. We'll be talking with Jennifer Washburn, the author of University Incorporated, and we'll be talking about that later in this hour. I'm speaking with George Irani, who is a professor at the Royal Roads University in British Columbia. He was previously the Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace in Washington, D.C., and he also was a professor at the Lebanese American University in Beirut, Lebanon. And George, following the assassination of the former Prime Minister Hariri in Lebanon, there's been unprecedented demonstrations in the street. It seems that the Lebanese people are quite emboldened, even though the Syrians came in and essentially ended and stabilized the country after a long, bloody civil war. It was there was a lot of resentment, but nobody really spoke out against the omnipresent presence of the Syrian army and the intelligence people. But now they're quite vocal. So where do you obviously, I'm interested to find out what you think about who was behind it. But let's just begin with, where do you think this people power movement is going to take the country?
I would not use the parallel with the Ukrainian example, the Orange Revolution, if you want, because they tried to create the red and white revolution in Beirut or something similar. Already, the news today is that tomorrow's demonstrations have been canceled because the army is in force now downtown Beirut. There will be sit-ins, that the opposition had called for, but the big demonstrations that were promised, I don't think they're going to take place. I think the news from Beirut this morning is that the opinion is to cool down things. Tried to find some kind of a political compromise to, get the Syrian out of Lebanon or till the Bekaa Valley, at least for the time being. But I don't foresee things getting out of control, getting out of hand for the next few weeks, basically.
Well, now let's go back to the first question then. Who do you think was behind the car bombing and assassination of Rafiq Hariri, who basically, they used to call Lebanon Hariri land. He turned the rubble into skyscrapers, immensely popular.
Yeah.
So who do you think was behind it?
Well, look, at in Lebanon, it's like, Chinese Pandora boxes. You open one and there are 10,000 others that you can use and do all kinds of interpretations. You know, many people have an interest in getting rid of him. But fundamentally today, who controls intelligence in Lebanon? That's what one has to look into. Regardless of the fact who benefits from this, who controls the security situation, who controls the roads, who moves and so on and so forth. You look at the Lebanese army intelligence and Syrian intelligence. These are the folks who really know who comes in, comes out, who moves and so on and so forth, number one. Number two, the execution of the assassination, you know, there's a very powerful bomb that, you know, some people are talking about napalm, the people talk about, you know, huge quantities of TNT or Semtex or whatever to, you know, to do that attack. Certainly someone in Damascus and Beirut in the higher-ups must have known that something was fishy and cooking. Number two, when you talk about Syria today, you have to be careful about who is leading Syria today. You know, the current regime is not in total control of what's going on. It's very interesting that, when was it, last week, the Syrian president Bashar al-Assad decided to change his military intelligence and appoint his brother-in-law, Asif Shaukat, as head of the Syrian intelligence. So that tells you something, there has been failure somewhere there.
Well, but he fired the former head.
He fired the former head, but it could be also that the folks who did that could be someone from the Deuxième Bureau, the Lebanese military intelligence. Because keep in mind, no one talks about that Rafiel Hariri and the current president of Lebanon, Emil Lahoud, who is a Syrian puppet, by the way, basically were at loggerheads. They basically never went along from the time that 6 years ago Lahoud was elected as president of Lebanon. Him and Hariri basically were totally in confrontation. They never agreed with each other. They were basically, you know, disagreeing on how to, you know, partition the cheese or the pie in Lebanon, okay, to do all kinds of projects and make money and so on. So that's something to keep in mind. So in a sense, who would benefit from getting rid of Hariri? Of course, the current president of Lebanon, who didn't like him all the way. So that could be one thing. Number two, you have also the various right-wing, extreme right-wing Christian groups, you know, the Pro-Aoun crowd are in Paris or elsewhere. These folks also have an interest in embarrassing the Syrians by doing something like this, with probably friendship within the Lebanese army and, you know, with a nod from the Syrians. So that the other thing could have also mafia nature, you know, because keep in mind, this guy was Hariri was a very big businessman, and he also had enemies too. Among the Lebanese, first of all, because when he tried to rebuild downtown Beirut Solidaire, he basically bought a lot of land, real estate in downtown Beirut for peanuts. And many people were really angry and mad at that, many Lebanese owners downtown Beirut. So that's another dimension. But certainly today, you find that Syria's credibility and policy and so on has been totally damaged. And they are trying to repair this damage. And the question is, what is the alternative? What do you do? Suppose the Syrians get out of Lebanon, what is the alternative? And what kind of quid pro quo the Syrians will get from getting out of Lebanon? Because that's the other dimension, keeping in mind that the Golan Heights are still up in the air. No one knows what the fate of that is concerned and so on.
Well, George Irani, there is, given the most of the, the fingers have been pointing at Syria, and you mentioned that Bashar Assad is not totally in control. He was the accidental heir because Assad's heir was the likely heir was killed in a car accident, I believe. He was an ophthalmologist in London, recalled, to run the family business.
Yeah.
And they are, of course, the Alawites. They're the Shia minority presiding over the Sunni majority in Syria. And while Syria came in to end the civil war, they are basically pretty unwelcome. I mean, I guess it would be the equivalent of the Mexican army running California, wouldn't it be?
Well, Ian, let me just briefly give you the biggest historical picture, but briefly. The Syrians entered Lebanon with the invitation of some Lebanese leaders, including the Christians, who at that time, Christian right-wing forces, who at that time were really beleaguered and were being defeated by the coalition between the leftist nationalist forces allied with the PLO in Lebanon. Number two, when Syria entered Lebanon in early 76, it entered with a green light, by the way, from Washington and from Tel Aviv. At that time, I remember, you know, Prime Minister Rabin making statement in Israel saying, well, we're very happy the Syrians have entered Lebanon because they are killing more Palestinians than we did in the last few years, basically. Plus Washington, you know, under the prodding of the late King Hussein, who went to see President Ford in the White House to convince him to let the Syrians in because they would be the best to pacify the civil war in Lebanon. So these are important historical facts that one has to keep in mind. Number two, the Syrians were allowed to stay in Lebanon all these years, from 76 until now, with the consent and approval from Washington. In fact, in 1990, when you had, towards the end of the Civil War, the Taif Accords, you had a confrontation between General Aoun and against the Lebanese army and the authorities, and then the U.S. gave the green light to the Syrian Air Force to bomb the presidential palace where Aoun was sitting and tried to force him out of the country. And then, he, in fact, he escaped to Paris and so on. That was because the United States needed Syrian troops and support for the first Gulf War. If you recall, when Bush Père was waging his first Gulf War, he needed all kinds of a big coalition. So that's another dimension to keep in mind. So on one hand, you need them, the Syrians, to pacify Lebanon. You need them to be part of your coalition in the Gulf and to try to be a role there. And then on the other hand, you beat them on their hand, you tell them, hey, folks, you have to get the hell out of Lebanon. In the meanwhile, you have the Golan occupied. You have, of course, now you have the U.S. occupation of Afghanistan, of Iraq, the Israeli occupation of the West Bank and Gaza and East Jerusalem and so on. So you have to put this in this fullest picture. And this is where the Syrians are coming and say, okay, well, you know, there are UN resolutions that we need to get out, and there's a Taif Accords and so on. But then there's another dimension, too, that we still have our land being occupied, the Golan and so on. What's going to happen with that? So these are things that one has to keep in the picture.
Well, I don't know that there could be any quid pro quo in Golan versus getting out of Lebanon. I mean, there's no question that the United States has used the Syrians in a realpolitik way. But on the other hand, now part of our government is beating up on them and threatening them and putting them on the list along with Iran as the next targets after Iraq. At the same time, we understand the Syrians are working with the CIA doing outsourcing torture.
Yeah.
So there's all kinds of strange stuff going on here.
Right.
But let me run a scenario by you, which I talked to some senior CIA people who from the Middle East who suggested that. Well, let's go back to 9/11. A few days after 9/11, the first crisis meeting that President Bush held at Camp David with the War Cabinet, the first thing that was offered up was by Wolfowitz, which was to attack Iraq, even though bin Laden's people were in Afghanistan. On the surface, that was insane. But part of the reason for Wolfowitz, apart from the neocons' fixation with Iraq, was that the Pentagon actually had a war plan for invading Iraq. They didn't have one for Afghanistan.
Right.
They clearly have a war plan for Syria, and they clearly are developing one for Iran.
Right.
If you were to, as Seymour Hersh has suggested from CIA leaks and other leaks, that this administration plans to go after Iran in the summer, if you were to go after Iran, you would have to neutralize Hezbollah in southern Lebanon before you did that, because Hezbollah is a creation of the mullahs in Iran, and they would unleash them as retaliation on soft targets here. They allegedly have cells in Canada and possibly here in the United States.
Yes.
So are events that are unfolding now in Lebanon connected to a ticking clock that says we're going to invade Iran in the summer, and before we invade Iran, we've got to neutralize Hezbollah in Lebanon?
Could be a plausible dimension. Actually, I'll put it in a larger picture. I think that, of course, fundamentally, if you go back to what the Bush administration foreign policy objectives has been since it came to power 4 years ago, basically, first of all, to extend U.S. hegemony around the world, to revamp the U.S. military, guarantee the sources of oil, and, of course, keep on waging this global war on terrorism, as they call it, the GWOT. These are the three major objectives. And, of course, today the last two strongholds in the region, the Middle East, that are opposing Pax Americana, of course, are Iran and Syria. And they are the two countries that are being targeted by the neocons and their friends in the White House and the Pentagon and so on. But the problem is that Iran is not an easy prey. Iran's going to be very dangerous. And the Iranians know that. And ironically, notice the signing yesterday of the Iranian-Russian agreement regarding a nuclear plant. That means, a poke in Bush's eyes, saying, whatever you want, but we also have our own interests to deal with, and we'll continue doing that. So that's another. Yes, the issue of Hezbollah is crucial, and crucial in terms of, you know, how can you extend Lebanon's sovereignty when you still have a militia roaming around in South Lebanon, still pretending that it's defending Lebanese southern territory from Israeli attacks and so on. And two is the whole issue about the Shia-Sunni balance in the whole region. Today, the Sunni communities, be it in Iraq or in Lebanon, Saudi and so on, they feel defeated. They feel totally disenfranchised because they lost power in Iraq with the, you know, kicking out of Saddam Hussein and his criminals. Number two, they feel also disempowered because they just lost one of the major, you know, figures in Sunni Islam, Rafi al-Hariri, who very wealthy, global connections, very rich and so on and so forth, very powerful with the Saudis and so on. So they feel today disempowered, and they are trying to bring back, to get back to power. So one scenario is that basically if you force the Syrians out of Lebanon, then the regime will fall in Damascus, because if they don't get back the Golan and they lose Lebanon, they have nothing to show for their you know, policies over the last 30 years. So the regime will fall. Possibly you're going to have a Sunni-dominated government in Syria.
One that's possibly religious-based, too.
It could be religious-based, fundamentalist, you never know. So that's another dimension to keep in mind. Also, the insurgents today that are fighting in Iraq against the American occupation are mostly Sunni Muslims. So that's another dimension to keep in mind. So all in all, it's not going to be an easy trip, because if you try to touch Hezbollah in Lebanon, basically you can bet that you're going to go back to a civil war in the country, like in 75, 76, because at that time in Lebanon, the civil war took place because of the Palestinian presence, military presence in South Lebanon, the PLO and so on.
Now, but George, how could you take on Hezbollah, assuming that the administration wants to preemptively bomb the Iranian nuclear sites? They may, you know, they may not want to have a land invasion. I don't think they're that crazy. But if they do anything, you know that the mullahs in Tehran will unleash Hezbollah. That is their creation. That is their only foreign policy ace in the card.
Yeah.
So how would you go? How would you neutralize? The only way you could neutralize Hezbollah would be using the Christians and the Israelis.
That could be, or, you know, you need to read the Syrian army, because they are the only ones who really know where Hezbollah is and so on. But Hezbollah today, keep in mind, this is also in Paris last week during the Bush-Chirac meeting. Keep in mind the French are still disagreeing with the U.S. or the Bush decision to put Hezbollah on the list of terrorist organizations. The French don't want to do that because they know that Hezbollah has members within the Lebanese parliament. Hezbollah has schools, hospitals, and orphanages, and you name it. So that's the other. This is why I'm saying there's a danger you can end up having a civil war within Lebanon that the Syrians could foment too, because the Syrians can say, okay, well, you Americans are putting pressure on us. You want us to get out of Lebanon. We're going to show you what we're going to do. So they will foment trouble between Sunnis and Shias in Lebanon, and we'll go back to a civil war type situation. And then the Syrians will tell the Americans, okay, folks, you see, our presence is needed in this place, because if we leave, they're going to kill each other, basically. So, and it's interesting that as of now, the Shia leadership, be it of Hezbollah or Amal, you know, they've been temporizing. They did not play the role that the opposition has been playing in Lebanon. Mm-hmm. They've been always saying, be careful if you want the Syrians out. You know, the Syrians are here. They are still needed. We cannot get rid of them at this stage and so on. Plus, keep in mind that the Alawis of Syria, those who are in power today, Bashar al-Assad and his family, and the Shia of Lebanon, they have a lot in common. They have the alliance with Iran, and also they are all the same religious background. You know, Shias and Alawis have a lot in common.
Right, and of course, you know, we know that that this ridiculous invasion of Iraq, the Bush's blunder, is handing over Iraq to the Shia.
Yeah, so, absolutely. They already did.
Yeah, it's a done deal. So, well, I thank you very much for joining us, George. There's a lot to talk about. I'm afraid we're running out of time. And we'll stay in touch.
Most welcome.
Thanks. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Dr. George Irani, who is a professor at the Royal Roads University in Vancouver, British Columbia, and he was formerly the Jennings Randolph Senior Fellow at the United States Institute of Peace. He also taught at the Lebanese American University in Beirut. I'm now speaking with Bradley Martin, who is a veteran foreign correspondent and is now teaching journalism at the Louisiana State University. Previously, he served as the Asia Bureau Chief and Editor of Newsweek, the Asian Wall Street Journal, Asia Times, and the Asian Financial Intelligence. And Bradley Martin has a new book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. And years ago, Bradley, I moved into a house that Jane Fonda used to live in, and we still used to get mail from the North Koreans in these tacky envelopes. You know, they obviously had been opened before we got them. And I remember reading this stuff or trying to read it. It was all about the Juche philosophy, right. Self-reliance. And it was cult-like and crazy. But I guess the ultimate irony is that if you have a regime that's built on the Juche philosophy of self-reliance, and you can't even feed your own people, how do you look yourself in the mirror? I mean,
well, Kim Jong-il, of course, doesn't have much difficulty looking himself in the mirror. He was born to this extremely powerful family. He was spoiled as a child. He was raised with a great sense of entitlement. So I don't think he has much trouble looking himself in the mirror. It is a problem for him that that the socialist economy has not worked, and that he has to start thinking of making some adjustments, which he has been doing.
Well, he's assumed a godlike status. I mean, his father, which is the quote from your book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader.
Right.
The dear leader. Is he the dear leader or the great leader? I can't remember.
Well, he was the dear leader in the past, and now they want us to call him the great leader because it's a different Korean word for great, but he's also great now.
Uh-huh.
His father is the ultimate great leader, and he, of course, is the president, even though he's dead.
Right.
The father is still the president in perpetuity.
But it seems, though, that their ubiquitous grip on that country is starting to loosen a little because of their inability to feed their people. The place was run as such a tight police state that you couldn't travel anywhere, even across town, without a permit from the police. And just for weddings and funerals. But now, because people are having to forage for food, they're traveling all over the place. It's apparently you can bribe the police more readily. There are Chinese right. cell phones available, and there's been a flood of defections across the border. Not just political types, but ordinary people as well into China. And it's also worth noting that the Chinese, who President Bush is more or less saying, you know, you guys are supposed to help us out here with North Korea, in China. The most popular movies, the most popular music, fashion, everything in China is from South Korea.
So South Korean themes are also popular in North Korea among those people who are able to access them.
Right, but isn't that deeply ironic that
all right, you're talking about how the regime might be losing its grip. To some extent, I think that is true, and of course, it's what the regime the Kims worried about for decades, and that's why they kept their country isolated. But Kim Jong-il also understands the process. He understands how communism failed in other countries, and he decided long ago that he was not going to make the same what he considered mistakes as some of the other leaders. So, for example, when the Great Famine came in the 90s, it was Kim Jong-il himself who told his security people, ease up and don't enforce all these rules about travel and so on. So although we're just reading stories about this now, this has been going on for a long time now. And by easing up, he probably prevented the kind of boiling up of frustration that might have challenged his regime in a much more serious way. So as it is, you do have a gradual process in which people are becoming less worshipful and more entrepreneurial, more out for number one, less socialist. This certainly is proceeding, but are they going to rise up and revolt against Kim Jong Il? That might be wishful thinking on the part of people who think, oh, we shouldn't negotiate with such a monstrous person. We can just wait, and his people will take care of him.
Well, I'm not sure that is the. It might well be the Bush administration subtext. But the long and the short of it, Kim is making absolute fools of the Bush people, isn't he? I mean, he's just saying, poking in the eye, saying, look, I've got a nuclear weapon. You know, you went into Iraq chasing phantoms, and here I am waving it in your face.
Yes. Well, he's essentially saying, you cannot ignore me and just right. sit around waiting for the collapse of my regime. I'm going to make enough trouble right. so that you have to pay attention, and eventually you're going to have to negotiate with me. That's his.
So he really needs the nuclear weapon for his own survival. This is a.
Oh, right.
This is very personal.
Oh, yes. I mean, he knows very well that.
But he could also sell it, couldn't he?
That's the real danger. I think he. I mean, as opposed to the danger that he might actually marry one of these nuclear bombs to one of his long-range missiles and blow up Southern California, that is a pretty long-distance worry. A much more short-term worry would be that he would sell one to one of our enemies. The enemy
who would in turn use it.
Who might in turn use it, even if it's not stuck on the end of a missile, even if it's in a suitcase or in a shipping container.
Right.
So that would be the true worry, and that's why we really need to negotiate with this guy.
But the Bush administration's position is, you've got to give up everything before I'll even talk to you. And, of course,
we know
that that is a bogus position because it's never going to go anywhere. And we know that perhaps the subtext for making North Korea a threat is to justify a national missile defense, at least.
Quite right.
It seems to be the only rationale for it. But meanwhile, our South Korean allies are dumping dollars. Their central bank is now diversifying their portfolio out of dollars into euros.
Right.
There's no question that that South Korean leader Noh was here in Los Angeles speaking at the World Affairs Council. He made it clear. As much as you can in the world of diplomacy, that the South Koreans were scared to death of the Bush administration. They thought they were recklessly blundering towards war, and we almost had a war with North Korea under President Clinton in 1994. Where
we almost did, that's correct.
And the North Koreans fully mobilized, and they apparently, in your book, under the loving care of the fatherly leader, the North Korean soldiers, many of whom you've talked to as defectors, subsequently all expected to die, but they were nevertheless prepared to follow their dear leader's orders.
That's correct, and I imagine even now that would be the case. Certainly among the military, is much more isolated from these trends that you're talking about of people going across the border and listening to South Korean music and so on. The military, these guys from when they leave high school at 17, they're stuck in camps and they're indoctrinated constantly. And it's not until they get out 10 years later and get sent mostly to the coal mines that they start to reflect on how things might not be quite so much the way they were taught. This is generally speaking, and there is some change, there is some ferment, but I think I personally would not bet on it happening really quickly that these people would rise up.
Well, but in terms of the nuclear weapon, which Bradley was saying that perhaps it's more about the leader needing the nuclear weapon, but militarily, the North Koreans are already deployed an enormous amount of artillery and rockets
That's
and
right.
when they and periodically they threaten Seoul, the South Korean capital, which I think is about 20 miles from the border, with turning it into a sea of fire.
Right.
So they did. They wouldn't even need a nuclear weapon for that.
No, they wouldn't need that for that. But then.
But that's got to make the South Koreans. Isn't that why the South Koreans are so nervous about the bellicosity of the Bush administration?
Well, they certainly don't want a war. I mean, Seoul would indeed have to be a very early target if there were a war and if South Korea were participating, which it's hard to imagine that they wouldn't since our forces are on their territory. I do imagine that possibly the first target might not be Seoul, but someplace in Japan, maybe an American base in Japan or Tokyo or whatever, because that's a more nationalistic target.
If they could target a place in an American base in Japan with conventional weapons, then they could presumably target it with a nuclear weapon.
Might be able to. We don't know yet.
Right.
We don't know whether they actually have that capability to miniaturize those weapons and put them on.
No. Well, but they have a huge population of North Koreans in Japan.
Oh, they do. Yes. Uh-huh.
And they have quite some.
So there's plenty of spies, if that's what you're saying.
Yeah. Well, they could presumably bring a trawler over or something.
You know. Oh, they could. Yeah.
But the long and the short of it is that under Kim, they are becoming more isolated. When I mentioned the fact that the Chinese, the most popular songs and fashion and movies in China are South Korean, it's more of an irony about the Chinese being expected to mediate with the North Koreans when culturally they seem to have more affinity with the South.
Yeah, well, no, because of their changing economic system.
Exactly, yeah.
That is
and the Japanese are furious at the North Koreans for kidnapping their citizens.
Right, that is a kind of a side issue that is difficult to deal with in terms of the nuclear weapons issue because it's just infuriated the Japanese, and it's obviously a result of North Korean miscalculation. Kim Jong-il obviously thought that the Japanese... If he apologized, said, I confessed and apologized, he thought that the Japanese would behave like Japanese and say, oh, well, thank you for your apology. But instead, they became enraged.
Became a soap opera over there, hasn't it?
It's not going away.
Yeah, the people are, and there's still a few people, and they demand the bodies if, you know, they've handed back the live ones, and they say the rest of them are dead. But
it's truly a national issue in Japan.
Yeah. So, and from the Chinese point of view, their incentive would be to cooperate was that they don't want South Korea and North and Japan to go nuclear, right?
They don't want that, but they also don't want North and South Korea to merge into a single country that has U.S. troops in it.
Mm-hmm.
So, essentially, China wants the status quo. Sort of maybe status quo without nuclear weapons. So China's a bit. It's not clear which way China should go in its own interests here, but certainly they do not want a unified Korea on the South Korean model with American troops on the Yalu River, as they were in the latter months of 1950.
Mm. But. Just in terms of going back to Clinton, where you know we know that they made deals and in exchange for ending their plutonium nuclear program,
right.
they give them some oil and light water reactor, and all of these things have been dragging their heels. We've reneged on the oil, and the reactor's, I think, still incomplete. And it's obviously, nobody says it's easy dealing with them, but the long and the short of it is, by naming names and drawing a line in the sand, the Bush people haven't really accomplished anything, given that the guys turn around and said, look, we've got nuclear weapons now, and we know from A.Q. Khan and others that they're in the market. The North Koreans will sell anything they have, and they've been selling their ballistic missiles like hotcakes. So,
I mean, the Bush administration is in a bind because actually that Clinton 1994 plan was working as far as keeping the plutonium program frozen. It did work up until the time that the Bush people nudged the North Koreans and they unfroze it and started making weapons.
So, right, but they did it on the basis that they said that Clinton got conned because the North Koreans were secretly developing a uranium program.
Right.
And which is not
that's true in terms of the spirit. It's true that the North Koreans violated the spirit of the agreement, although it did not say anything specifically about the uranium enrichment program.
Right, but the long and the short of it is that the weapons that he claims to have, the CIA long ago estimated they maybe have two plutonium devices, and now they're saying maybe he's got eight.
Right, and these are devices from the plutonium program.
Exactly, that was unfrozen.
The uranium program that the Bush administration got bent out of shape about, which was a smaller and newer
right.
program.
So on Bush's watch, they've gotten more dangerous.
I'm afraid that's true, and I don't want to push that point too hard because I would personally like to see the Bush administration take stock and say, well, you know, let's reassess this thing and go in with a different approach. So I would personally not like to sit around on the sidelines and say you really screwed up. But you know, if you push me to the wall, I have to say it was a mistake. It really was a mistake.
Well, but I think isn't it easy for ideologues to point fingers and name names? I mean, the bottom line with the North Koreans is they are a disgusting regime, and they are . You know, maybe the guy is a demented little pygmy or whatever Bush calls him.
Loathsome, I believe.
Loathsome pygmy, yeah. But once you get through, you know, castigating them, you still have to deal with them, you know?
Well, I think this is the point. And what we have here, it's the realists versus the ideologues. So the Bush administration has now decided to go whole hog ideological back to the Woodrow Wilson days, which didn't do us much good at the time. Our effort to spread democracy under Wilson were mixed.
Well, but he didn't have the support of the Congress. Bush has got the whole ball of wax.
Right. So. Well, we'll see. I think the Bush administration would be mistaken to imagine that regime change could be accomplished easily, or that the regime that came out of it would be something that they would like, because if they push for a coup d'etat in North Korea, who has the power to do that? Only the military, not the civilians. Mm-hmm. So, and there are some really nasty guys in the military, and they may be even worse than Kim Jong Il.
Right, and they're even more out of touch, from what I understand. That
yes.
You've told us that they
that's
just
right. I mean, he at least has slowly been coming around to the view that something needs to be changed, and he's been actually changing things.
Right. Well, he's always been a movie buff, right? So he has a little bit of interest in the outside world.
That's right.
And he likes good cognac and the good life. So
he does indeed, and that's why I say I don't think he has any trouble looking himself in the mirror because he has that sense of entitlement. But you know, put that aside. Can we negotiate with him? And I believe we could, if only we would. And you know, I think, of course, both sides would need to give and take, but I think we would need very high-level emissaries. We would need someone of the stature of former President Bush to represent our side in the sort of penultimate talks to get these two together. And, you know, maybe the titular head of state of North Korea, maybe those two could have a conversation just to get things rolling.
Well, but Jimmy Carter was the one who saved the day, wasn't he, by showing up?
He was indeed, and Kim Il-sung was so happy with Carter had visited him and shown him face that actually he was ready to change not only the diplomatic equation, but also he was. There are pretty good reports, which I include in my book, that he was thinking of changing things more drastically at home as well.
But Jimmy Carter, by the way, Clinton was furious with Jimmy Carter.
He was.
Because Jimmy Carter forced them into making a deal.
That's right.
Because he was just going to go on CNN and tell the world.
Quite right. Well, I don't suppose anybody would ask President Carter to go back over there because they might fear his freelancing. But as I say, we do have other former presidents who could be enlisted as a high-level emissary. And this Kim Jong-il himself responds very well to high-level people who give him face, who treat him with respect and, you know, civilly. Mm-hmm. And there have been several visits by such people when he would make snap decisions that seemed to go against his previous policies. And the results could be very good if we tried something like that. It could fail. I'm just saying we would be remiss if we didn't even try to do that before we pushed farther with some of the methods that we already know don't work. That is, we know. I mean, I hope they know in Washington that a war would be an incredibly bloody affair. We've heard the figure. $1 trillion damage and a million casualties, I think, was the term. I mean, that's from a former U.S. general in charge of troops in Korea.
I thank you very much for joining us,
Been Bradley my pleasure.
Martin. And for your book, Under the Loving Care of the Fatherly Leader, North Korea and the Kim Dynasty. Again, thanks for joining us.
Thank you.
Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking there with Bradley Martin, who is a veteran foreign correspondent and who teaches journalism at the Louisiana State University. He's formerly the Asia Bureau Chief and Editor of Newsweek, the Asia Wall Street Journal, the Asia Times, and the Asian Financial Intelligence. And I'm now speaking with Jennifer Washburn, who is currently a fellow at the New American Foundation. Formerly, she was a fellow at the Open Society Institute and a senior research associate for the Arms Trade Resource Center of the World Policy Institute at the New School of Social Research. Jennifer Washburn writes for The Atlantic, The Nation, and The American Prospect, and she's the author of a new book, University Incorporated, The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And Jennifer, the notion of an academic whore is not exactly original. I mean, people have in every profession sell out. I guess that's the nature of all of us. But give me a sense of what the corporatization of examples of the corporatization of universities in this country.
Sure, I'd love to, Ian. I think that it's certainly true. We've seen a degrading of various different sectors of our society, increasing conflicts of interest, and the university is really becoming enormously commercialized. Some examples for you. Kmart recently endowed a chair at West Virginia University, which required its holder, the professor who held that chair, to spend up to 30 days a year training store managers. Stanford University, certainly an institution with a great deal of prestige, recently launched a multi-billion-dollar center on global climate change, which is heavily funded by companies like ExxonMobil and other oil companies. And the contracts essentially allow those companies to determine which academic research projects will receive funding. So these kinds of intrusions into the university sphere are happening on an unprecedented scale, and are very disturbing in terms of shifting the university's priorities away from their basic core functions of teaching and academic research.
Well, I remember speaking recently with somebody, I can't quite remember who it was now, and I offered my puzzlement at how appalling education is in general in this country, and that with the rise of the, you know, the Christian fundamentalists, are essentially the core group that elected or re-elected President Bush, that if you have more and more pressure from the Christian right in education, particularly in terms of teaching creationism, that you're essentially turning education over to sort of 14th century superstition. And wouldn't that mean that eventually the dumbing down of America, because it's in, you know, you can't be in the 21st century and believe that the earth was created 6,000 years ago in 6 days. And the answer I got was, well, the way that they're outsourcing jobs around the world, do they really care? Do corporations really care about an educated populace? Don't they just want factory fodder?
You know, I think that's a tough question. I think a lot of people in industry are much smarter than that. They realize that in the new information age, what is really going to give the United States its advantage is going to be having a highly educated, highly professional and well-trained workforce. And that's not just a workforce that is simply catering to industry, but that can think creatively and invent new technological discoveries that are going to propel us through the next age. So, I mean, historically, universities were at the center of launching the biotechnology revolution, the computer revolution. Without basic academic research performed at universities, those revolutions would never have happened. And so people in industry do realize that. And I think what's happened is their short-term interests are interfering with their long-term interests in preserving an area for research in our society that is truly disinterested, curiosity-driven research that can really drive the next technological revolutions.
So, Jennifer Washburn, are the corporate elite interested in a broader liberal education, which would then provide you with the kind of people that could initiate these breakthroughs, or are they interested, if you talk about Kmart having a chair to teach office management, are they interested in just in the narrow technocratic kind of cadre of corporate clones?
Well, certainly. Unfortunately, as I say, there are all too many corporate executives who aren't looking at the long term, and that's precisely the problem with having universities draw so much of their funding now from the private sector. In the past, one of the reasons that we as taxpayers subsidized these institutions to the extent that we did was because we believed it was important to have a sanctuary of independent thought in this country, a place where students could receive a broad-based education that was not simply a feeder system for industry, but rather a place to teach young people to think creatively and to be true democratic citizens of our society. And so I think that without any question, universities are going to lose that capacity if they become too dependent on industry for their support.
Well, how does it work, though? Because I know, for example, under the University of California system, that the regents, who are the people that run it from the top or set the policy and long-term agendas and goals, they are appointed by the governors, and quite often these are paybacks, aren't they, for financial support, fundraising, et cetera?
Yeah, there's no question that the regents are heavily sort of they don't have strong educational backgrounds. They have stronger business backgrounds, and often that means that they don't really have a true understanding of the academic culture and just how important academic autonomy really is. I mean, in California, your listeners may remember that back in December of 2000, Governor Gray Davis pledged about $400 million annually to create these new California Institutes for Science and Innovation. These innovation centers were going to focus on biotechnology, nanosystems, telecommunications. It all sounded like a great thing. These centers would be based, obviously, at California's universities. But two-thirds of the funds for these institutes came from matching grants from other sources, including nearly all the major blue-chip companies in America. And over this same period that the governor is promoting this kind of commercialized research centers, you see that public support for the University of California system declined by about 14%, even as enrollment was going upward by about 18%. So what's happening in state after state is that the governors and the regents are pushing the universities to become more commercialized, to focus on spinning off companies and generating commercial inventions, but they're losing sight of the primary function of the university, which is teaching and academic research, and so they're gutting the general education funds for these institutions that really go toward teaching undergraduate students.
Let me again remind the audience, if I may, I'm speaking with Jennifer Washburn, who is the author of University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And Jennifer is currently a fellow at the New American Foundation, formerly was a fellow at the Open Society Institute, and a senior research associate for the Arms Trade Resource Center of the World Policy Institute at the New School of Social Research. And what about the connections then with some of these recent scandals in terms of drug testing at the FDA and taking drugs off the market that the dangers of which were known for some time? Much of the criticism has been of the leveled at the FDA. But isn't it true that in universities, particularly in medical schools, the pharmaceutical companies have more than their foot in the door? We know that when doctors become practicing doctors after medical school, the pharmaceutical salesmen are in their offices all day. And now, of course, they advertise directly on television to encourage patients and consumers to ask for drugs.
Yes, Ian, you're absolutely right. I mean, the corporate intrusions into academic medicine are really disturbing. You know, historically, universities served a very important function. They essentially performed the clinical research that would determine whether or not these drugs were safe enough for the public to consume. And historically, academic institutions would receive money from the drug industry to finance those trials, but the trials were conducted at arm's length from the company. What's happened recently over the past 25 years is that universities are totally abnegating their own autonomy. And basically, they're allowing the drug company to control the raw data from their clinical research trials. The professors themselves now have such extensive financial ties to the drug companies. They serve on their speakers bureaus. They receive outside consulting income from them. That essentially there is no independence on the part of these academic investigators, and that's deeply troubling. I mean, just to give a recent example with the antidepressants that were recently the FDA determined that many of these very popular antidepressants, Paxil and Zoloft, were linked to a higher risk of suicidal behavior in children and teens. And it turns out that the public should have known about that information a long time ago. The reason they didn't was because many of the academic authors of the original research had really colluded with the drug companies to downplay these risks and not to publicize them in their published academic reports. It was only when an insider at the FDA looked at the raw data and carefully examined the raw data from all those clinical trials that he saw that, in fact, there was a twofold increase in the risk of suicidal behavior amongst the children who took the antidepressants versus those who were just taking a sugar pill. So that kind of complicity in burying negative research is extremely troubling. And certainly we want to know that our academic institutions are capable of performing that sort of disinterested research that the public can trust, and that at this point is in question.
And of course you have to add that the more recent pulling of Vioxx warnings from one of the FDA scientists, and amazingly it's gone back on the market.
Yes, that's right, and you no doubt saw recently that 10 of the 32 advisors to the government, 10 of the 32 advisors actually had ties to the companies that manufacture Celebrex, Bextra, and Vioxx. So somebody recently did an analysis and found that if those 10 advisors had not cast their votes, the committee would have voted by a significant majority that Bextra should be withdrawn from the market and that Vioxx should not return to the market. So it's not just a question of who's carrying out the clinical research, but who can the government turn to for expert advice if so many of these academic scientists now have direct connections to the drug manufacturers?
Well, when I was rather facetiously referring to academic whores being the notion that there's always been brains for hire, that it's always been people that will tell the rich and powerful what they want to hear, and it's an old, you know, practice in government. Whenever you don't want to make a decision, you have a study, and which you eventually ignore, you know, 10 years later or 5 years later when the study's finally completed and you've gone on and done what you want to do. So at the heart of that question, I guess, is what is the current state of academic culture? Are these people who are, you know, interested in knowledge for knowledge's sake and the pursuit of knowledge, or are they? I mean, where are the standards, and who's preserving the standards? If the the threat to higher education is that you know, the corporate world can't wait to get their hands on you, and they're not, you know, they're not interested in a broader picture. They're just interested in narrow talents, and they essentially hire people to tell them what they want to hear. And even if the evidence, say, if the drug is bad for you, that's beside the point. We want you to say that it's going to cure you.
Yeah, I think here the most important check on this system, and the only thing that is going to ensure that universities continue to value knowledge for knowledge's sake, and value the primacy of undergraduate education and the need to preserve a place in our society for independent thought, is really the
And the value of truth itself.
I mean, and the value of truth, exactly. And the notion that intellectual discovery is not simply driven by money, by the bottom line. I mean, the only thing that's going to ensure that is if the public continues to play a strong role in higher education. And this is what's so troubling, is that we really have this larger question to deal with, which is the place of higher education in our society. And do we still consider higher education to be a public good that's worthy of public investment and support? Do we still believe that the primary function of the university is to educate students? If we do, then it's absolutely critical that universities continue to be able to rely on U.S. taxpayers to support their operations. And unfortunately, what's happened is that the share of state budgets going to fund the general budget for higher education has dropped nationally by about one-third since 1980. And you've seen similar declines in federal support for academic research. So these institutions are in a difficult position. And what troubles me is that they are increasingly justifying their existence and going to state legislators and saying, well, you know, we will make ourselves more useful to industry to try to justify their existence instead of defending their traditional core responsibilities. I mean, we all know that the most important asset that universities produce is, in fact, their students. And increasingly what troubles me is that universities are eliminating full-time professorships. They're relying more and more on adjuncts and graduate students to handle most of the teaching, at the same time that they're paying six-figure salaries to some of their research professors who literally have it written into their contract that they do not have to do any teaching. So the priorities that these universities are taking is troubling.
Well, Jennifer, I'm afraid we've run out of time, but I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles and for your new book, University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. Again, Jennifer Washburn, I thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Hello again, I'm Ian Masters. I'm just speaking then with Jennifer Washburn, who's currently a fellow at the New American Foundation and is the author of University Inc., The Corporate Corruption of Higher Education. And I thank the producer, Louis Vandenberg, the engineer, Mark Maxwell, the assistant producer, Carol Coote. And this program and all previous ones are available at ianmasters.org. That's one word, IANMASTERS.org.